So the second talk this morning relates to worship, but it's more specifically over church calendar and whether Presbyterians are allowed to have a church calendar or not. You may detect that there is some high church envy on my part. I'd like Presbyterians to be more high church. I am blessed to have Lutheran and Anglican colleagues at Hillsdale College. It's a very Christian-friendly place. There are a lot of Roman Catholics as well. And I have to be careful what I say now because this may go out over the interweb at some point. But they are also great, wonderful colleagues. I prefer that our students remain Protestant. But anyway, back to the Anglican-Lutheran part of this. This is going to be a shameless self-promotion. But I do a podcast called the Paleo Protestant Podcast. Co-producer here helps out get these, Brad Isbell helps get these online, and he's added the musical touch to it, our bumper music. But that's a conversation between me and two history colleagues, one of whom is an Anglican, one of whom is a Missouri Synod Lutheran. And we kick around sort of common topics, what goes on in our various communions. And we also try to talk about ways in which confessional Protestants are not evangelical and not mainline Protestant, and the way so much of the conversation about American Protestantism or white American Protestantism doesn't really take into account confessional groups. So if you're interested in that, but that may also explain some of the my approach to some of these matters, though I think I've been thinking about these for a while. So one of the ways to think about church calendar, of course, is to talk about Lent, Advent. Then again, I don't know what the practice is here in the local churches, so I don't mean to step on anyone's toes, but I do oftentimes feel left out during Lent or Advent when my Anglican and Lutheran friends, not necessarily the guys I podcast with, but are tweeting all about all the blessings of these seasons of the year. And I find it to be oftentimes insufferable because there's a kind of sentimentality about it. There's also a kind of a lack of rigor in actually thinking through what observing these seasons of the year does or is supposed to do. So I have one example. I was looking back through some old blog posts, but I think this came from an evangelical fellow talking about Lent. Heightened devotion is fruitful for a season, but cannot be sustained indefinitely. The Christian calendar offers a sustainable rhythm of which Lent is a part, and the fasting of Lent gives way to the feasting of Easter. Fasting and feasting are interconnected disciplines that teach us to love the King and his coming kingdom. In Lent, we learn to confess our sins, practice self-denial, and take on the humility of Christ. In Easter, we learn to rejoice, exalt, and feast in Christ's victory. As historian William Harmless says, curious last name, Harmless, in these two liturgical seasons, Christians drank in by turns the not yet and already of New Testament eschatology. Now, what's stuck out to me in reading that, but it also oftentimes stands out to me in reading other people recommending Advent or Lent, and sometimes it also seems like these two seasons kind of run together, that the effects of both are the same, even though they're anticipating different parts of Christ's life. But why wouldn't you want to be moderate? Why wouldn't you want to be repentant the whole year? Why only for 40 days before Easter? Or why what you're doing with Advent? Would you only do it for roughly 24 days? I don't know how long. I think it's about 4 weeks, right? 28 days. Why only then? I mean, so you get to take a break. You get to take a vacation from serious Christian living. It would seem to me, I mean, this is what Reformed Protestants try to do. They try to turn this on to do it all year round, which could make it really onerous to be a Reformed Protestant. And it is a challenging form of Christian devotion. But it's still, it's just a curious thing that the way people talk about Lent and Advent. So why don't Presbyterians observe the church calendar? Well, of course we do in really culturally appropriating ways. In the sense that we do observe Christmas usually, we do observe Easter kind of. So we sneak it in different ways. Oftentimes the churches I've been in, it's been part of, well, you're going to have all these newcomers coming to church, and they're going to be there, so you got to say something about that holiday. But then, you know, it's a time of evangelism or something. So there's a recognition that this church calendar is going on during the year, and we need to participate in it in some way because people may be coming to church that Sunday. But the reason we don't observe the church calendar is the regular principle. That's the short answer again. The Bible doesn't require it. Because if we follow the Bible on a church calendar, what would we have? Well, there is a church calendar in the Old Testament, right? And we don't follow it. Looking around on websites, I was able to put together these. Passover is one coming from Leviticus 23:5. Then there's the Feast of Unleavened Bread, Leviticus 23:6 and following. There's the Day of Pentecost, Leviticus 23:15. There's the Feast of Trumpets, which modern-day Jews call Rosh Hashanah, Day of Rejoicing, which is mentioned in Leviticus 23:23. There's the Day of Atonement, also known as Yom Kippur, Leviticus 23:26. And then there's the Feast of Tabernacles, a seven-day celebration of the great fall harvest, Leviticus 23:33. And then there's the Last Great Day holiday, which is adjacent to the Feast of Tabernacles, which is the eighth day. It's considered a separate feast from the Feast of Tabernacles. It's Leviticus 23:36-39. And then there's one more, Purim, which comes from the book of Esther, which isn't really much part of Jewish practice, I don't think, but it is responsible in part for a really great movie by Christopher Guest, who made those mockumentaries like Best in Show and the like. But for your consideration, it's a movie being made about Purim. It's called Home for Purim, this Jewish family that's trying to observe this holiday as the mother of the family is dying. And it's a very Jewish movie, inflected movie at this point. And then the producers come in at the end and say, no, this is too Jewish. So they repurpose the movie as Home for Thanksgiving instead of Home for Purim. It's a very funny movie. But so if you wanted a biblical church calendar, you could just go right to the Old Testament and do that. But lo and behold, Christians don't follow the Old Testament calendar. Why? Jesus. It's always the right answer in Sunday school, and it works here as well. The Confession of Faith. If you turn there, chapter 7, this comes page 924. Paragraph 5 talks about the difference of the covenants between the Old and New Testaments. This covenant was differently administered in the time of the law and in the time of the gospel. Under the law, it was administered by promises, prophecies, sacrifices, circumcision, the Paschal Lamb, and other types and ordinances delivered to the people of the Jews, such as the system of holidays. This biblical calendar, all for signifying Christ to come, which were for that time sufficient and efficacious through the operation of the Spirit to instruct and build up the elect in faith in the promise of Messiah, by whom they had full remission of sins and eternal salvation, and is called the Old Testament. But then there's a shift with the gospel. Paragraph 6, under the gospel, when Christ, the substance, was exhibited, the ordinances in which this covenant is dispensed are now, back to the means of grace, the preaching of the word, the administration of the sacraments, of baptism and the Lord's Supper, which, though fewer in number and administered with more simplicity and less outward glory, it gets to this issue of seriousness and how do we display what's going on in worship. So we want to try to make it simple and less outward glory and yet still have it be something really serious. Yet in them it is held forth in more fullness, evidence, and spiritual efficacy to all nations, both Jews and Gentiles, and is called the New Testament. So you see that clear contrast here between the rites and ceremonies and observances of the Old Testament church, as it were, and then what comes with the New Testament church. And so we don't have that old church calendar anymore, which is why then people go to a new Christian church calendar and why Anglicans and Lutherans follow that instead of the Old Testament. If you followed the Old Testament, you'd be in theonomous land, I guess. So Christians don't celebrate these. What do we celebrate? Well, if you turn in the confession again to chapter 21, the chapter on worship and the Sabbath. I'm curious why they didn't separate this into two chapters. It does point, in some ways, I think I could use this to back up my earlier lecture about the importance of worship and the Lord's Day and Sunday, because it's chapter 21 is all about religious worship and the Sabbath day or Sunday. Make sure I have the right chapters here. Paragraph. So look at paragraph 7 and 8 in chapter 21, page 932. Paragraph 7, as it is the law of nature, that in general a due proportion of time be set apart for the worship of God. Curious, again, they mention the light of nature, or the law of nature in this case. Nature somehow indicates that we should set apart time to worship God. So in his word, by a positive moral and perpetual commandment binding all men in all ages, he has particularly appointed one day in seven for a Sabbath to be holy unto him, which from the beginning of the world to the resurrection of Christ was the last day of the week, Sabbath, and from the resurrection of Christ was changed into the first day of the week, Sunday, which in Scripture is called the Lord's Day, and to be continued to the end of the world as the Christian Sabbath. So, again, this signifies that with the coming of Christ, there's this dramatic shift of the holy day moving from the seventh day to the first. And our pastor back in Hillsdale did a Sunday school series, I believe, on the eighth day language. In some ways, you could view the switch from the seventh day, the Sabbath, to the first day of the week, Sunday, as a kind of fulfillment of that eighth day pattern, which is in the Old Testament and is in, say, that last great day festival, which is adjacent to the Feast of Tabernacles. But I don't remember that series well enough to replicate that here, but it is something worth considering. So anyway, this is the reason why we don't have a church calendar, because now we have one day. It's the Lord's Day. The Christian Sabbath. That's the holy day. And then it goes on, paragraph 8, the Sabbath is then kept holy unto the Lord when men, after a due preparing of their hearts and ordering of their common affairs beforehand, do not only observe a holy rest all the day from their own works and world and words and thoughts about their worldly employments and recreations, but also have taken up the whole time in the public and private exercises of his worship and in the duties of necessity and mercy. So we could say more about the nature of how we observe the Lord's Day, and people sometimes regard that that understanding of the Sabbath with all of that activity going on as, say, more a burden than a rest. Say more about that. But still, the important point to keep in mind is that the Old Testament believers had all of these days that they observed, these holy days, and then it's wiped away with Christ, because Christ is the fulfillment of all of that. And now Christians have this weekly holiday, holy day, the Lord's Day on Sunday. Calvin wrote this about why Christians don't observe the holidays. the reason why he's talking about Paul frees Christians, and there's lots of discussion in Paul in Romans 14, 1 Corinthians 8, and I can't remember the other passage that's important. I think it's Colossians, about Sabbaths, new moons, things like that. Paul gets into that and does free Christians from it, although he seems to allow some observance of it by individual Christians in their sort of private spaces, perhaps. But Calvin writes, the reason why Paul frees Christians from the observance of them, the holidays, is that they were shadows at a time when Christ was still in a manner absent. For he contrasts shadows with revelation and absence with manifestation. Therefore, those who still adhere to those shadows act like one who should judge a man's appearance from his shadow, while in the meantime he had himself personally before his eyes. For Christ is now manifested to us, and hence we enjoy him as being present. The body, says he, is of Christ, that is, in Christ. For the substance of these things, which the ceremonies anciently prefigured, is now presented before our eyes in Christ, inasmuch as he contains in himself everything that they marked out as future. Hence the man that calls back the ceremonies into use either buries the manifestation of Christ or robs Christ of his excellence and makes him in a manner void. So the point, long-winded point there perhaps, is that all of these Old Testament rites and ceremonies and holidays were shadows of the real thing. And when the real thing came, there was no reason to continue to observe the shadows. And Calvin goes on at different points then to talk about the ways in which the sacraments and preaching, you think about Christ's real presence in the supper, if you think about preaching as the word of God, these are ways in which Christ is really present with us now. The substance is here with us. So again, there's probably an urge on the part of the people who observe the liturgical calendar to try to replicate in some ways an ongoing presence that the Old Testament holidays did embody or represent. So there's something natural to us, as even the confession says, about the law of nature, saying that it's appropriate to spend certain times worshiping God. But they're confusing this idea of a liturgical calendar with the very real idea and observance of the Christian Sabbath, the Lord's Day, Sunday. So this leads me then to talking about the liturgical calendar that Presbyterians actually do have. We have one. We just don't talk about it the way we should. So what we have is a week. We don't have a year. We have a week. And I would argue that in some ways a weekly observance is superior to an annual observance. Because if you're thinking about an annual observance, there are two ways you can structure the year. You can follow the lunar calendar, which is weird. And if you know anything about Ramadan or Islam, this year Ramadan was in April, which I found to be really strange because one of my favorite films about Muslims in Michigan, Fordson, it's about high school in Dearborn, which has the most Muslims outside the Middle East of anywhere else in the world. And there's this high school that Henry Ford created for it, named after his son, Fordson, but it's predominantly Muslims there. And it's about the kids on the football team. Most of them are Muslim. And they're preparing for the upcoming football season during Ramadan. And so they have to fast during days when they're doing two-a-days in practice. You're not doing two-a-days in April. So Ramadan, because of the lunar calendar, shifts all over the place. It was, at that time, in August. This year, it was in April. So it's hard to sort of figure that out. You kind of have to follow the moon and its cycles to see when it's coming. The solar calendar is not much easier because every day is not literally 24 hours long. It's 23 hours, 59 minutes, and so many seconds. So it doesn't compute. God kind of has the last laugh on us in this. So that's why we have to have a leap year to compensate for that offness. And there was the old Julian calendar, which didn't compensate for that really well. And in 1560 we have the Gregorian calendar from a pope who adopted this first, which then established a kind of leap year way of catching up and making sure that dates were regular. And this is important if you're following the liturgical calendar, because you want everyone on the same page when it comes to Easter. When are they observing Easter? When are they observing Christmas, etc.? You don't want Easter happening one year during baseball playoffs, another year happening during NBA playoffs or something. So there's that. But it wasn't until 1752, I believe, that the British Empire adopted the Gregorian calendar, the calendar that we now use. So Ben Franklin, about whom I've wrote, he was born 1706 on January 6th. But when the British Empire adopted this calendar, they lost 10 days. So Franklin's technical birthday is no longer January 6th, the way it was with the Julian calendar. It's now January 17th. And there were riots in parts of the empire over losing 10 days. So again, the solar calendar isn't necessarily reliable either. And not to mention that if we know that Jesus was born on December 25th, which we don't know, but if we know that, why does Easter jump around? Easter is as historical as the birth. When Christ died was a day. There was one day. Why wouldn't that be the same day every year? Why does it jump around depending on when Passover is, except the lunar full moon after whichever it is? It's kind of weird, isn't it, if you're going to assert the historical reality of the resurrection? Wouldn't it be one day? Okay, so back to this point, though, about the importance of the week, which leads to the significance of the Lord's Day. Was it there in the language of the confession? Well, it was in a sense. The end of paragraph 7, when it says, to be continued until the end of the world, the Christian Sabbath. We don't see this. We don't recognize it. And believe me, I mean, I'm not this weird that I'm carrying around these thoughts with me all the time, that I'm thinking about preaching Sunday morning tomorrow, that like somehow I'm catapulted up onto Mount Zion and, you know, I'm now up there and I can see angels and whatever. Nor do I think about the week this way. I think about likely the way many Americans think about our work weeks. And it is peculiar that we use the word weekend to describe Saturday and Sunday, even though Sunday is the beginning of the week. Why would you call it weekend? But for most people, it's the end of a work week. For Christians, though, Sunday is the beginning. It's a day of rest before the work week. Anyway, but there's eschatological significance. There's a redemptive historical significance to the week that I would say does not pertain to the calendar. Annual calendar, whether it's lunar or solar. First of all, the week is part of the creation order. It doesn't take much to think about this. Whatever we make of the days of creation, whatever their length was, there were 6 days, and then the seventh day, God rested. So we have a pattern at the very beginning of time and of human history of the week standing out there as something that is so important that even God works on the 6 days and then he rests on the seventh. So the week points back, and the Sabbath itself points back to this creation event, to the beginning of human history, to the beginning of God's relationship with human beings. Exodus 20, of course you know, but the fourth commandment, remember the Sabbath day, to keep it holy. 6 days shall you labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. So the reason why we follow this pattern, this weekly pattern, is because it's the pattern that God followed. It's the pattern that God established in the very creation of the world. And then the reason, again, why we switched from the seventh day as a day of rest to the first day of the week as a day of rest is, as the confession here has indicated, because of Christ and Christ's fulfilling of the Old Testament and the significance of the resurrection in redemptive history. So, again, the week points to the resurrection of Christ. It points back to creation. It points to the resurrection of Christ. Question and answer from the larger Catechism 116. You don't need to turn there, but what is required in the fourth commandment? The fourth commandment requires all men the sanctifying or keeping holy to God such set times as he has appointed in his word, expressly one whole day in seven, which was the seventh day from the beginning of the world to the resurrection of Christ, and the first day of the week ever since, and so continue to the end of the world, which is the Christian Sabbath, and in the New Testament called the Lord's Day. So the resurrection is a huge deal in the history of redemption. Such a huge deal that the day of rest switches from the seventh day to the first day. And there are people who still don't buy that. There are Christians who still, Seventh-day Adventists, they still think the Sabbath it should be on Saturday. And thank the Lord for the Seventh-day Adventists, because many OP congregations rent buildings from Seventh-day Adventists because they're empty on Sundays. We don't want them to switch. Maybe we do, but still. But not only does the Lord's Day point back to creation, and it points to the significance of the resurrection, but it also points forward to the wedding supper of the Lamb. And here the Heidelberg Catechism, I think, is useful for capturing this language. So it would be useful to turn to this, because Presbyterians are less familiar with this than the Reformed, obviously. So this is on page 891 in the Psalter Hymnal. Lord's Day 38, or question and answer 103. And this does get into territory about the ways in which, say, the Puritans and Presbyterians in the British environment were they more severe or less severe than the Reformed on the continent, the Dutch and the German Reformed churches, or even the French Reformed, or even Geneva. So we could think about that maybe a little bit here. But what is God's will for you in the fourth commandment? First, that the gospel ministry in schools be maintained, and that especially on the festive day of rest, I diligently attend to the assembly of God's people, to learn what God's word teaches, to participate in the sacraments, to pray to the Lord publicly, and to bring Christian offerings for the poor. They didn't need to bring offerings for the ministry, because the ministers were paid by the state. Second, that every day of my life I rest from my evil ways. Let the Lord work in me through his Spirit, and so begin in this life the eternal Sabbath. So, I mean, there's a lot going on in that second paragraph, but there is this idea of the eternal rest that's coming in the new heavens and new earth. And the Lord's Day does also point forward to that. The Lord's Supper gives us a foretaste of that wedding supper of the Lamb. So all packed into this one day is creation, resurrection of Christ, and the wedding supper of the Lamb that's coming at the end of human history. I mean, it's hard to have more compact into one day. And wait, there's more. It's every week. It's just every week. Can you believe it? You don't have to wait for it to come until next year. It's every week. It won't let you go. It's like a mother-in-law. I said that only because May John Mankin, one of my favorite writers, says that conscience is like a mother-in-law whose visit never ends, or something like that. So this is another reason, I think, why the Lord's Day Sundays are so important. It's this day when the means of grace are delivered, as it were, and we are fed and sustained in the Christian walk. It's the day set apart for that kind of activity. And then on top of all that, what's happening there is pointing us backward in time, creation, resurrection, and forward in time. It's a day packed with significance. It's truly wonderful. But again, we sort of, I don't know why we always take it for granted, as it were, or maybe it was just too arduous to observe. But I would also make a point that one of the reasons why I think people go from being evangelical to Anglican or Lutheran, or even sometimes Presbyterians do this, because they like the liturgical calendar. There's an order to the liturgical year. And so it gives people rhythms of piety that they can follow. And I think a lot of people like that. That's why we have life coaches, I guess. And we have all sorts of people to give us instruction about how to live our lives. And the liturgical calendar is a way to do that. But the Lord's Day, I would say, is a better liturgical calendar. Advent ends. Lent ends. Christmas is one day a year. Easter is one day a year. The Lord's Day is 52 days a year. And not only that, not only does it have all this power-packed significance, but you actually have to order your time according to this so that you can rest from all your, and now I'm going to sound heavy-handed maybe, get into the Puritan thing that, you know, we don't do anything of our worldly activities, etc. And I don't know what your practices are with professional sports and going out to eat and all that. I'll let your sessions handle that. But say, for instance, if it were simply not working on the Lord's Day, and there are professions that require people to work on the Lord's Day, so I'm not saying anything about people in medical professions, people who work at power plants or whatever. I mean, there are things that are necessities of life, which is why the Confession and Catechisms talks about acts of necessity and mercy. So, you know, there are those considerations to whether we do work on the Lord's Day. But if I'm going to, you know, give a final on a Monday to students or some exam, I've got to make sure that I'm not working it on Sunday. That's my conviction, at least, in my practice. I try to practice that, which means I've got to get it done at least by Saturday. And even then by Friday if my wife and I are entertaining on Saturday. I mean, so all these other things come along with trying to observe the Lord's Day. You have to order the rest of your week so that you can actually prepare well enough for Sunday so that you're not doing any work on the Lord's Day. And I'm not one of those Jewish/Christians who wouldn't even turn the stove on the way some observant Jews do. They don't believe you should turn on the stove on Sabbath. So, you know, I don't go that far. I do cook on the Lord's Day, which I guess is a kind of work, because it's a feast day as well, I can get away with it, I guess. But it's still... If you want a form of Christian piety that calls you to a cycle of Christian observance and piety, that it's rooted in the calendar in some way, the Sabbath gives us that. The Lord's Day gives us that. I don't think we Presbyterians have done enough to make this an alternative liturgical calendar. But we have one. And Reformed and Presbyterianism are redolent with people who have followed the Lord's Day really carefully. I'm going to give you an example of this here shortly. But if, because of this preparation that goes on, I mean, it is akin, if you observe your weeks preparing for the Lord's Day, it's akin to what people may do during Lent when they give up certain things for Lent. Or they have certain kinds of devotional practices that they only do during Lent. Or even what people do in Advent. Although it's really hard with how commercialized Christmas has become to somehow keep this period leading up to Christmas free from worldly concerns in some way. You're out there having to buy all sorts of gifts. You're having to go all these sorts of parties. And then, wait, there's more. There's still yet more, one more week of partying after Christmas leading up to New Year's Day. And if you're Eastern Orthodox, wow, you can then have Christmas on January 6th. And you can just let the party keep going. Because they're still on the Julian calendar, I guess. That's part of the reason for that difference. But so it takes a lot of work. I've heard Brad say on his podcast, quoting me, which I get this from a historian of colonial Presbyterianism, that Reformed piety is really difficult. And it is. It's demanding. It doesn't have the bells and whistles that Roman Catholicism or Anglicanism or Lutheranism has. It's very simple and ordinary, as the Confession says about the New Testament and the New Covenant in the New Testament. It doesn't have all those elaborate ceremonies. I mean, imagine what it would be like to go to worship and see some animals slaughtered and sacrificed. That would be kind of weird, but it might get your attention. I mean, we don't have that. We have a little thimble of wine, depending on how you, a little piece of bread, like the Woody Allen joke in, I guess it was Annie Hall, the two Jewish women at a resort in the Catskills, says the food is so bad, and yes, the portions are so small. And you know, the portions of the Lord's Supper, to talk about this as a feast, it's like, are you, well, yeah. But it's one way that we ceremonialize this activity. But that's the sacrifice that we have before us. It's nowhere near what's going on in Old Testament worship. So it's hard. It doesn't. It's demanding, and it doesn't give us all of the stuff that other Protestant traditions may give us. So here's another handout that gets to the importance of the Lord's Day. That's really, well, I don't know. Thank you. And it comes from a Reformed source. People here are probably too young to remember a magazine called the Reformed Journal. And this comes from that Reformed Journal. This was a publication put out by people in the Christian Reformed Church, started in the 1950s. A lot of Calvin College faculty wrote for it, but they eventually recruited some evangelical types to write by the 70s and 80s. As Kuyperianism or Neo-Calvinism was beginning to spread its influence. But this comes from a 1981 edition when they were writing about differences between Reformed Protestants and Evangelicals. And this is a long passage on the Lord's Day, but it's really worth considering for a variety of reasons, which I will talk about as we go through this. So this fellow, John Timmerman, taught English at Calvin College and grew up in Northwest Iowa, which is a very much a stronghold of Dutch American life. He writes here, Willa Cather speaks of the incommunicable past. Excuse me. One can communicate facts of Sunday. In my boyhood, in a little Iowa town, the air full of bells three times that day, the well-filled churches and horse barns under August sun and January chill, the nature of the church services, the pietistic regimen that controlled all activities. What is difficult to convey is the ubiquitous sense of Sunday that pervaded the day from dawn to dusk, from the first cock crow to the last wan chirp of the cricket. The stillness of the town, I never experienced such Sunday stillness again. Sunday was church in Orange City, Iowa, in the first decades of the century, 20th century, not 21st. I suspect that it is so even now, 1981, in the little pockets of piety that dot Northwest Iowa, though it can't be as still in the town or in the homes as it was in my youth. There were three services, which I attended with simulated docility. The preacher delivered three sermons before his often critical sheep, three different sermons, dressed in a somber Prince Albert, sweating it out, that's a suit, I believe, in August afternoons without air conditioning before a whir of variegated hand-propelled fans. He spoke in these churches, some of them large, without the aid of electronic devices, and a voice of good timbre could be heard on the street through the open windows. There were always competitive babies in the crowd. quieted not by artful jouncing, but by breastfeeding. As the sermon pounded on, squirming little boys were pinched, sometimes fractious. Older boys in the back seats were policed by elders. Dutch psalms were fervently sung, while a lathering janitor pumped the bellows of the organ at 110 degrees. There was no choir, an irrelevant impertinence. The heart of the service, I guess I should comment, three services a day. So if you want to talk about the Puritans as rigorous when it comes to Lord's Day observance, well, the Dutch were pretty close. I don't know that the Puritans ever had three services. The heart of the service was the sermon. Upon that, the evaluation of the preacher and the determination of his ecclesiastical fortunes depended. Then, as well into the 60s, it was as rhetorically fixed as the terza rima. Apparently, all texts were best analyzed and interpreted in terms of 3 points. I remember a preacher saying, one more point and then we go home. Whether the content was brilliant or mediocre, it was formulated in terms of an introduction, 3 divisions, and application. The 3 points were often chosen with care and memorably phrased. These pegs to remembrance enabled certain people to recall sermons accurately for years. A lady of 88 wrote me recently saying about some sermons she had heard, I know the introduction and application he made and often talk about them. She also gave the 3 points of several sermons she had remembered for 50 years. Such fixed rhetorics may seem wooden, but its pneumatic helpfulness was striking. As a boy, of course, I had no interest in these sermons. I spent my time counting the pipes in the organ, the panes in the colored glass windows, watching the consistory up front, and daydreaming. I'm glad that later I learned to appreciate the meticulous preparation, craftsmanship, and meditation that went into their making. Some of these older ministers operated on volubility, but others on a lot of mind and heart, and not a few had style, some had class. These older ministers, whose spiritual authority was enormous and sometimes tyrannical, had fixed minds. Their influence is sometimes hard to understand now that when every Tom, Dick, and Sadie with a strong D average in high school has the right to express opinion. Then when preachers said, thus saith the Lord, they were inclined to believe it. Some of them had a center of Zion complex, abrasively attacking the other Christian communions and microscopically scrutinizing their fellow preachers for theological slippage and a general sense of thorough comprehension of the full counsel of God. One admires certain qualities in such people, their intelligence, spiritual concern, uncommon diligence and zeal for the church, but one grows weary of their omniscience. One gets tired of people who are always right, whether they be professors, preachers, or editors of church papers. In all the years I have observed ecclesiastical controversies, I do not remember a protagonist who admitted being wrong about anything that really mattered. Frequently proved easier to start a new denomination. Now, again, this is 1981, and the CRC at this point is beginning to drift. So, not to say that you would necessarily recommend the kind of pastors that he's describing here, who may have been a little bit inflexible and wooden in it, but still keep that in mind, that he's writing somewhat nostalgically about his youth and that time, also recognizing the problems with it, and recognizing those problems at a time when the CRC is trying to come to terms with its place in America and in the evangelical world, as it were. So just keep that paragraph with that context in mind. But then he goes on, these 3 services, 3 trips to church, so they didn't stick around for 2 services, then go home, come back for 1. They went to church 3 times. 3 meals pretty well consumed the day. You could imagine that would be the case. What time remained was to be used in a way compatible with the spiritual tone of the day. To many, this all sounds like a hard, hard religion, as well as something of a bore. Indeed, it took something out of one, but to recapitulate the point earlier made this morning, it put something real into one also. The church was a sanctuary, a renewal of hope, a confirmation of faith. These people did not have easy, pleasure-filled lives. They had a profound sense of the mystery and misery of human existence. There were no protective barriers. I remember my mother crying over the deaths of little children. Children were sometimes marred by smallpox, weakened by scarlet fever, dead of diphtheria. Diseases now almost routinely cured carried off parents leaving homes fatherless and motherless. Fearful accidents occurred on the farm. Hail, storm, and drought brought destruction to crops. But the death of the saints was precious in the sight of the Lord, and in the eye of the storm was the providence of God. How often these people prayed for a rainbow, how often they found a spiritual rainbow in the church where God spoke to them through his servants and promised cure for all misery. Sorry for getting choked up there, but I'm a little bit like Jordan Peterson at times, I guess. He just recently spoke at Hillsdale, and he almost broke down at the end of his address, and I was thinking I'd be there when he breaks down, but I guess he's sort of on the verge a lot of times when he speaks. But this is particularly moving to me to think about not simply the point that Lord's Day, the means of grace, sustain us in our walk, but there are these really difficult elements of life, including death of loved ones, hardships in life, suffering that we hear about a lot, but I don't know that we experience suffering the way people out on the Great Plain may have experienced it, and to think about the kind of comfort that we receive on the Lord's Day in those circumstances is also quite moving, at least, if not comforting. He goes on, at that time and even into the 60s, there was a remarkable consensus as to the meaning and practices of Sunday. Although the Bible did not specify the number of services to be held on Sundays, there again, regular principle leaves some of this up to judgment. Congregations attended with notable faithfulness and did not appear to grow weary of that kind of well-doing. Even though the services in the earlier decades of the century were a surcease from loneliness on the empty prairie, a stay against loss of identity in a strange world, thinking of the immigrant experience, and the warm concourse of friends, these were not the reasons that brought them to church. What did bring them to church was a felt spiritual need and a sense of duty. They believed God wanted them to come as often as they could and that it was good for them to be there. That kind of consensus has been eroding for years, whether out of spiritual amplitude, secular diversions, boredom, or alienation. So also has the drawing power of popular preachers. It has been decades since I have seen churches jammed to hear a particular preacher. I can name a half dozen preachers during the 30s and 40s who packed the evening service wherever they went. The sense of duty in going to church and the pleasure anticipated through the sermon have both waned, so that today's churches with excellent ministers rope off many pews for evening services during the summer while some of the saints go marching off. And then one last point here. The consensus on Sunday behavior is also waning. Whereas in the early decades of the century, attendance at church three times was common, today attendance twice is lessening. The blue laws have almost vanished. If a member of my old church in Iowa had spun his Buick over to the Blackstone Cafe in Sioux City for a Sunday dinner of prime rib and cocktails, he would have been in danger of losing his membership. If one does that in Grand Rapids today, he risks only losing his shirt. The old blue laws were based on the idea that the Sabbath is a day of sacred assembly, and that wherever you live, it is a Sabbath to the Lord. The older generation thought God made the Sabbath for man to ensure rest and spiritual growth, not to do what he wanted. They were uptight and possibly self-righteous about Sunday. The present generation is relaxed and self-righteous about it. Funny how self-righteousness never goes away. I'm thankful for the spiritual insight and inspiration that I have received over the years from many sermons to have attended. Half of them would have impoverished me. To have fragmented the spirit of the day with antithetical secular diversions would have made it almost indistinguishable from Thursday. So that is an older, very old, almost 40 years old view of Sabbath days from over 120 years ago or so, maybe 100 years ago. And it's remarkable how dated in some ways it seems, both about the original three-day, three-service-a-day Sunday compared to what's going on in the 80s, and I think we've changed a lot even since the 80s in regard to the Lord's Day. But it does make several of the points that I've been trying to make about the significance of the Lord's Day, significance of the sermons, the kind of sustenance that the Lord's Day gives to us. I think it's also useful for thinking about the difficult, not simply the difficulty of it, how to be prudent about trying to encourage people in this kind of religious devotion and practice to keep the Lord's holy and Lord's Day holy in some sense, and knowing that congregations, individual Christians, families can only bear so much. I don't think you can somehow ramp it up to three services a Sunday, say starting in the fall, we're going to go for this. You've got to be wise about it and see what people will bear. We shouldn't lose sight, though, as difficult as it may be, and not having children, I don't know all the difficulties of rearing children and the demands that might make upon families. So also need to take that into account, obviously. But still, to not lose sight of how significant the Lord's Day is and what a blessing it can be and how important, how necessary the means of grace are that are administered on the Lord's Day. So I'll stop there.